This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. Discussions between grandparents and new parents reveal just how much advice around what's best for baby have changed in just one generation.
Over the last 30 years, we have learned so much about the best way to take care of newborns.
That story and more coming up this West Virginia Morning. Support for West Virginia Morning is proudly provided by Luke Frazier. Far southern West Virginia has been without passenger rail service since 1979. As Curtis Tate reports, a federal study hints at a potential revival.
The Federal Railroad Administration has been studying the potential of expanding Amtrak service in West Virginia, including making the Cardinal from New York to Chicago a daily train. A PowerPoint presentation from the agency at least hints it might be considering a revival of a train that was discontinued more than 40 years ago, the Hilltopper. That train once stopped in Bluefield, Welch, and Williamson on its way from Boston and Washington, D.C. to Catlettsburg, Kentucky. Despite the support of powerful lawmakers, including the late Senator Robert C. Byrd, the train fell to sweeping Carter administration cuts on October 1, 1979. The Federal Railroad Administration study doesn't commit to restoring the Hilltopper, but could revisit the route in the future. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Curtis Tate in Charleston.
West Virginians with black lung will have the opportunity to learn about eligibility for benefits at upcoming educational events. Emily Rice has more.
Events held in Fairmont and Madison from March 19th to March 21st will allow current and former coal miners suffering from black lung to get assistance with filing or refiling claims and receive eligibility information. According to the U.S. Department of Labor, there are currently 4,200 people receiving program benefits in West Virginia. The events are held by the U.S. Department of Labor's Federal Black Lung Program. More information can be found at our website at wvpublic.org. For Appalachia Health News, I'm Emily Rice in Charleston.
Appalachia Health News is a project of West Virginia Public Broadcasting with support from Marshall Health. U.S. Senator Joe Manchin is advocating for more accurate categorization of West Virginia communities after federal funds were pulled back. Chris Schultz has more.
Last month, the Environmental Protection Agency rescinded award funding for three West Virginia counties to purchase zero or low-emission school buses, citing errors in their identification of rural areas in mountainous regions. Manchin sent a letter to Peggy Carr, commissioner of the National Center for Education Statistics, Tuesday, urging her to consider ruggedness scales that impact travel of students to and from school in NCES's measurements. NCES is responsible for classifying public school districts into four categories: rural, town, suburban, and city, that help determine how federal resources for education activities are allocated. The letter argues current methodology leads to much of Appalachia being miscategorized as urban. Manchin's letter states that more than 80% of West Virginians live in rugged areas, compared to a national average of 11%. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Chris Schultz in Morgantown.
A familiar species is coming back to West Virginia. Jack Walker spoke to conservationists about how they're preparing for new arrivals.
Beavers are back in West Virginia, and according to conservationists, that's a good thing. Their dams increase biodiversity, store groundwater, and filter pollutants. Beavers are native to wetlands across North America and never fully disappeared in Appalachia, but they were hunted to near extinction during the 18th century fur trade. Fewer people hunt beavers for their pelts now, which has helped their population grow. But more beavers can also bring trouble. Their dams cause flooding, and beavers sometimes chew trees that protect rivers from erosion. Allison Zach, who founded the Human Beaver Coexistence Fund, said that's why conservationists are putting wire fences around trees along riverbanks.
People learning these non-lethal strategies is a way to keep beavers, like creating wetlands for other species and providing all the benefits that they provide for the ecosystem, but also addressing people's concerns about their favorite trees coming down.
Protecting both trees and beavers is a group effort. That's why Casey Walters with the Potomac Valley Audubon Society brought a team of volunteers to a Charlestown wetland Tuesday.
So yeah, it's not just conservation is not just about the relationship with the wildlife. It's also about the relationships of the human organizations that exist and keeping us all working together for a common goal.
Walters estimated that Charlestown's Cool Spring Preserve is currently home to two beavers, but with the river's trees protected, it'll be ready for more to come. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Jack Walker in Charlestown.
This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. It's 7:49. Partly sunny today, highs in the 60s and 70s. Partly cloudy tonight, lows in the 40s. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, a slight chance of rain in the afternoon, highs in the 60s and 70s. Friday, a chance of rain and thunderstorms with highs in the 60s and 70s. Support for WVPB is provided by the Couples Counseling Center, meeting the therapy needs of West Virginia couples at every stage of relationships. Learn more at couplescounselingcenter.online. Discussions between grandparents and new parents reveal just how much advice around what's best for baby have changed in just one generation. From sleep positions to even clothing and nutrition, what's recommended or even considered safe has shifted more than many realize. In the first installment of a new series called Now What? A series on parenting, reporter Chris Schultz sat down with Dr. Adriana Diakive, an assistant professor of pediatrics at West Virginia University, to discuss how things have changed and what doctors recommend today.
Why has that change happened? Why has so much changed around best practices for infant care?
Well, the answer is simply based on the evidence. So over the last 30 years, we have learned so much about the best way to take care of newborns. And one of the things that here at WVU, and I think sort of more globally, that pediatricians like to practice is what we call evidence-based medicine. And the recommendations for newborn baby care are based on what we consider the best evidence. And that is constantly changing and evolving. And we have learned so much, not just in the last 30 years, but even in the last 10 years, about the best way to feed and care for babies.
Let's start with sleep. Why is the back the best position for an infant for sleep?
Being on the back is the only safe sleep position for an infant. And it is true that throughout all the generations, our parents, perhaps our grandparents, everyone was taught to put their baby to sleep on their tummy. And it is true that in general, babies are somewhat more comfortable on their tummy. However, around 30 years ago, we learned that babies who are put to sleep on their tummy have about a 50% increased risk of dying of sudden infant death syndrome, or SIDS. And that evidence is so strong that the American Academy of Pediatrics issued a recommendation and a campaign called the Back to Sleep Campaign that sought to educate parents that one of the most important things that they can do for their newborn baby's health is to always put them to sleep on their back.
Why is the focus on milk or formula only now?
When we refer to milk, of course, we're speaking of human breast milk. So mom's breast milk has such a tremendous variety of health benefits. It almost, you know, we couldn't list them all during this talk. And that if we're not going to be taking mom's breast milk, then an infant formula is the only safe way to feed your baby between birth and 12 months. If a baby gets too much water mixed in with their milk or their formula, the way that a baby's kidneys work, the baby can actually get sort of water overloaded. Is sort of an easy way to think of it. The way that the baby's kidneys work and their fluid balance works, they can't just get rid of that extra water so easily. So it can have some pretty negative health effects for the baby.
Temperature regulation. I'm talking about grandparents, parents, aunts, uncles being very insistent that a baby must have a hat on at all times, even if you're in an 80-degree room. Talk to me a little bit about what the modern recommendations are towards ensuring that a baby is at a comfortable temperature.
My parents both immigrated from Ukraine after World War II, and they were absolutely convinced that not just cold air, but even a draft in the house could cause serious illness. And what the evidence shows, Chris, is that is absolutely untrue. In fact, the opposite is true. So with newborn babies in particular, it's very important to avoid overheating or overbundling a newborn baby, because overheating is one of the biggest risk factors for sudden infant death syndrome, apart from being placed to sleep on your stomach. And I can't emphasize enough how important it is to avoid overheating a newborn or an infant.
What can you tell me about how the pediatric field's perception or understanding of colic is changing even as we speak?
Our perception of colic has changed dramatically over the past several years. So this is a field in which there's a lot of active research. Colic had for generations been understood as abdominal discomfort, but there's another definition of colic, which actually has nothing to do with tummy pain or with pain at all. And that interpretation of colic, which we don't quite have a separate word for yet, we now understand as more of a developmental process. We think of a baby when they're born full term as really having been born 3 months too early. And this is the idea of the fourth trimester, right? So babies, when they're first born, in order to even be able to pass through the birth canal, a baby has to be born about 3 months earlier than their brain is and nervous system is really ready to face the world. And so as a result, the baby's parent or caregiver acts almost like an external nervous system for the baby during the first 3 months. And human babies are unique in the animal kingdom, really, in being utterly helpless when they are born. They depend on their parents for everything, and newborns have absolutely no ability to self-soothe. And that's because during that first 3 months, their brain and nervous system is so immature and it's growing and changing so rapidly that a baby can easily become overstimulated. And when we've looked at babies who have this unexplained crying, which we also call colic, we found that these colicky babies actually are not in pain. And we can test for this, actually. They're not in pain at all. It's more that their nervous system is so overstimulated that the only way that they can express that overstimulation is with this inconsolable crying. And it's kind of a tough thing to wrap your mind around when you've always been taught that your baby's unexplained crying is because they have excess gas or colic or tummy pain.
That was Dr. Arianda Diakiev speaking with reporter Chris Schultz about the modern best practices for infant care. To read a longer version of this interview, go to our website at wvpublic.org. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University. West Virginia Morning is produced with help from Bill Lynch, Brianna Heaney, Chris Schultz, Curtis Tate, Emily Rice, Eric Douglas, Jack Walker, Liz McCormick, and Randy Owey. Eric Douglas is our news director, and he produced today's show. I'm your host, Teresa Wills. This is West Virginia Morning.